Good morning. Great to see everyone and Happy New Year. It's wonderful to see some of my colleagues I haven't seen in a while. Folks visiting, welcome to your house committee today. Thank you for coming and spending your time with us today. Speaker, thank you for being here as well. Team, thank you. Hopefully it will be an exciting time and we'll have some fun as we go down the path. Hopefully we can all learn from this journey. A lot of people have asked me about what this committee is to do. I'll tell you exactly what I told everyone else. It's really pretty simple, and it goes something like this. If today there was no education system in North Carolina, what would this body of individuals do to create one, and what would it look like to carry us for the next 100 years? Needless to say, we have things that are at our hands, tools, technology, tremendous amount of knowledge from a system that was applied over 100 years ago to perhaps do what we can best, create for the future of our kids as they exit, perhaps a new and improved system. A lot of people are concerned about education. I don't have to tell y'all. You read it each and every day. You see it. You hear from it from your constituents to my colleagues. We get numerous emails about people across the state about education in every level, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a student, whether you're a parent, whether you're in a supervisor, in administration, just absolutely across the entire system of education, we have concern. And so we're going to hear a little bit about that concern. We're going to learn, first and foremost, today, I think you're going to find it very enlightening. When I talk to my constituents, they ask me questions, and often I have to explain to them the different nuances of what we do here as far as what's a law, what's not a law, what's a constitutional requirement responsibility, what's not a constitutional requirement responsibility, what's a rule, how's a rule applied, how's it created, how's it enacted, what does it do, who has the authority to do rules, and then policies, departmental policies, interdepartmental policies between sub-agencies in the agency. Developing policies. Who has the authority to do this? Where they come from? How they originate? Are they approved? Are they checked off? Or are they just implemented? So these are questions I get each and every day from some of my constituencies. And the nuances and differences between what's a general statute and what is a policy. What's a general statute and what is a rule? Oftentimes policies in place or rules implemented, and most people think that's the law, when actually it's not. So we're going to hear today about the foundation of who has responsibility for what in education, and then the different nuances between constitutional requirements, responsibilities, general statutes, rules, and policies. And with that, we have a scholar with us today, and thank you for spending your time with us. Look forward to hearing your discussion. Before I go any further, I'd like to also offer opportunity to my co-chairs, Representative Hugh Blackwell, Representative Pat Hurley, Representative David Willis, if you have any insight you'd like to share at this time with the members of the committee and the general public. We have three passes. Thank you very much. And now we'll go to one of my favorite parts of every committee, is the introduction of our Sergeant-at-Arms. Thank you all for your service to us and the people of North Carolina. Jonas Cherry, David Layton, Thomas Terry, and your friend and mine, Stafford Young, thank you for the work that you do for all of us. We have a very large team, if you look. We all consistently thank them for their performance. They're very smart individuals. I've had the opportunity to work with each and every one of them over this past short session. Yuck. The session to end all sessions. The mother of all sessions, I guess, is what we could call it, in both policy and in appropriations, and in just basically working on some potential for general statutes. But thank y'all for being with us as well. With that, I will start off by, I've met all my duties and requirements, haven't I? Bringing up Brian Gwynn. He's our team leader, and he's going to talk to us about the review of the charge, and he is also the committee counsel. Brian, you're welcome to.
The House Select Committee on an Education System for North Carolina's Future shall study issues related to education in elementary and secondary schools, including but not limited to the following: requirements of the standard course of study, outcomes of the standard course of study, including the appropriate metrics, opportunities for students to demonstrate competency at their own pace, funding and outcomes of current programs, including partnerships with nonprofits that support the standards and outcomes of sound basic education, and any other issue deemed relevant by the chair to the charge of the committee. The committee will consult with parents and students, leaders in both small and large business and industry, as well as public schools and other academic institutions in its study. The committee may seek information from experts in the fields of education and any other field deemed appropriate by the senior chair.
I'm sure you want to go through it again? I'm teasing. As you can see, we have a task in front of us. I'd like to go through and just briefly touch on the agenda for today. Next, we'll have Jeanette Doran, president of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law and currently on the Rules Review Commission, presentation on the Constitution and Statutory Division of Authority for Educational Policymaking between the General Assembly, the State Board of Education, and the Superintendent of Public Instruction. After her first conversation about the Constitution, we will pause for any questions and answers from members of the committee, and then after that, we'll move on to her presentation regarding rules and policy. And then once again, we'll have questions and answers from committee. And then probably the most important of what the committee will be doing is I want you all to be thinking and putting your caps on. I sent you an email kind of saying, you know, what's some of your thoughts? What's some of your views? And we will have that discussion at the end of this committee to share with the rest. The next committee meeting will be on February 7th at 1 p.m. We'll go over that again at the end of our agenda. Right now, I'd like to introduce Jeanette. Jeanette, you may take the podium. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. As the chairman said, my name is Jeanette Doran. I'm president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. I am also a member of the Rules Review Commission. I have been for, I think I'm now in my fourth term. This is my second term as chair of the commission. All of my remarks today, however, I speak only in my capacity on behalf of the Institute and not on behalf of the Rules Review Commission. So just wanted to make sure that was out there. So before we get started, I would like to just briefly note for you that I think staff might overestimate my ability to read that screen from afar. So please bear with me if I occasionally have to look down at the monitor. All right. I'd like to start, and you should all have a pocket-sized copy of the state constitution. I'd like you to turn your direction to Article 1, Section 15. That's on page 5. And in it, it states, "The people have a right to the privilege of education, and it is the duty of the state to guard and maintain that right." That is, at its crux, the fundamental aspect of the state's responsibility to education and to our school children. So that brings us to, you know, sort of the crux of what I'm talking about today, which is the Division of Educational Authority. We have that in the Declaration of Rights that people have the right to a privilege of an education, but education as a constitutional responsibility is largely fleshed out in Article 9, which is the article governing education generally. The North Carolina Constitution establishes the General Assembly's ultimate authority and responsibility for public education and its responsibility over the State Board of Education. If you turn to Article 9, Section 2.1, it states the General Assembly shall provide by taxation and otherwise for a general and uniform system of free public schools, which shall be maintained at least 9 months in every year, and wherein equal opportunities shall be provided for all students. So that's what we currently have. That's the state of the Constitution at the moment. Important to understand what today's current constitutional requirements and framework are, it's important for us to go back to the very beginning. Now, anytime I say that to my children, they sort of cringe at me. But it provides the framework for understanding pretty much everything we have in the Constitution, education in particular. courts often do this. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, we had a three-judge panel here in Wake County decide the redistricting litigation. And in it, they portions of that opinion went back to talk about King James II and the Glorious Revolution. So I am not the only person who's going to tell you that history matters. It provides the context for interpreting our Constitution. So I got ahead of myself. We've had a portion, we're currently on our third Constitution. We had the 1776 Constitution. We had the 1868 Constitution, which you sometimes hear referred to as the Reconstruction Constitution, because it came about during the Reconstruction era in the wake of the Civil War. We currently have a Constitution from 1971. But let's start at the very beginning. In 1776, our Constitution provided that the legislature should provide for a school or schools for public education. And then it sort of sat dormant for a little while. And then in 1835, the legislature by statute created what was called the Literary Fund, and it was the first governing body for public education in North Carolina. So that goes back, again, 1835. We were trying to, as a state, focus on the development of public education. And we called it the Literary Fund mostly because the emphasis of public education at the time was in basic literacy, basic arithmetic. We weren't really focused on things like studying the classics or calculus. That just wasn't what the times called for in the early to mid 1800s. So we see that language, the right to a privilege of an education, manifest itself in the Constitution with the Reconstruction Constitution in 1868. That was then at Article 1, Section 27. And that created that language that the people have the right to the privilege of an education. It was the first time it created an affirmative duty in a constitutional sense for the state to provide a sound basic education, right? What we now describe as the opportunity for a sound basic education. So in 1868, the Constitution also created the State Board of Education. And I'd like you to very carefully read through now, again, I warned y'all that I could not read that screen from afar. So we have, all right, in 1868, we have the State Board of Education shall succeed to all powers and trusts that the president and directors of the Literary Fund and shall have full power to legislate. So that's the state constitution in 1868, giving the power to legislate to the State Board of Education. And, it continues, and make all needful rules and regulations in relation to free public schools and the educational fund of the state. But all acts, rules, and regulations of said board may be altered, amended, or repealed by the General Assembly. And when so altered, amended, or repealed, they shall not be reenacted by the board. Now, that suggests, that language, altered, amended, or repealed, suggests that the State Board of Education had to act before the legislature could. Because obviously, there's nothing to alter, amend, or repeal if the State Board hasn't already acted in some fashion to legislate or promulgate rules. So this body had oversight. They could alter, amend, or repeal, but they could only alter, amend, or repeal what the State Board had already done. But still, it's critically important for you to remember that going that far back, the legislature had the authority to alter, amend, or repeal whatever it was that the State Board of Education was doing. At the time, also, the State Board of Education was comprised entirely of ex officio members. The list of members for the State Board of Education back in 1868 read, not unlike a subcommittee of the Council of State. So you had the treasurer, you had the secretary of state, you had a number of those officers, which meant there was this sort of ongoing kind of tension between the executive and legislative branch that is, you know, part of the bane and part of the glory of our separation of powers. So what happened next? So that's the 1868 Constitution. Now, we realized the General Assembly was kind of subverting the authority of the State Board of Education, right? They didn't like what was going on. They kept creating these other commissions and these other committees. In fact, one report that was commissioned by the legislature and a report that was commissioned by the governor at the time, at the direction of the legislature, talked about there were three different commissions covering textbooks. You know, so you had redundancy, you had conflicts, because you had all these different bodies out there. So we decided we were going to clean things up, and we had a new amendment that was proposed. For a variety of procedural reasons, that amendment didn't actually come to fruition in the 1930s, as had sort of been the plan. But in 1942, voters approved a constitutional amendment that changed the state board's power. Now, a lot of this in the beginning is, again, directed at cleaning up some of the things that we had going on. So we had the State Board of Education shall succeed to all the powers and trusts of the president and directors of the Literary Fund. We have, in the next sentence, the State Board shall have the power to divide the state into a convenient number of school districts. But then we get maybe four or five lines from the bottom, and generally, to supervise and administer the free public school system of the state and make all needful rules and regulations in relation thereto. Now, that sounds very much like the Constitution that we had in 1868. But look at this last sentence. All the powers enumerated in this section shall be exercised in conformity with the Constitution and subject to such laws as may be enacted from time to time by the General Assembly. This is a far broader constitutional charge to the legislature, right? They no longer have to wait for the state board to act. They're not limited to just alter, amend, and repeal. They have a plenary. The legislature now has a plenary authority to promulgate laws, to enact laws with respect to education. This amendment also reduced the number of, we reduced the number of ex officio members of the State Board of Education. You will find in this amendment from 1947 that there is no longer an authority vested in the State Board of Education to legislate. So in 1868, the State Board of Education could legislate. Not anymore. Not since 1947, right? They were stripped of that power, not by this body, but by the voters of the state of North Carolina. So what happened? You know, what happened with this 1947 amendment in 1971 when we got our current Constitution? It's essentially the same thing. And the Supreme Court has observed that in various cases that we might have time to get to later. So this is the current language. The State Board of Education shall supervise and administer the free public school system and the educational funds provided for its support, except the funds mentioned in Section 7, which is county funds, of this article, and make all needed rules and regulations in relation thereto, subject to laws enacted by the General Assembly. So we have that same plenary authority that the General Assembly has the ultimate authority over education. What are our historical takeaways? The General Assembly has always been authorized to check the state board's power to some degree, right? It used to be limited to just alter, amend, repeal, but since 1947, it's been a plenary authority, and everything the State Board of Education does is subject to laws enacted by the General Assembly. Each change to the Constitution stated in more general terms what the legislature's authority is. And this is this final bullet point, and I should have had it in quotes. It comes from a Supreme Court decision, State Board of Education v. State, a review of the provisions of the North Carolina Constitution and its changes to these dictates clearly shows that the General Assembly currently has the power to enact laws with respect to education and to govern the state board's rules and regulations. That is a massive responsibility, and I'm sure none of you take it lightly, but it is the mission, or it is the directive of the voters that education ultimately be under the authority of the legislature. So, what exactly is it that the State Board of Education does? Well, those duties and responsibilities are laid out by statute. And we see the Constitution provides that framework. So the first thing the Constitution does is it says, all right, State Board of Education, it's your job to supervise and administer the free public school system and the educational funds provided for your support, for its support, and make all needful rules and regulations. Again, that's the sort of, that's their constitutional framework. That's what the Constitution says about what it is the State Board of Education does. But because we have this language that it's subject to laws enacted by the legislature lays out the kind of overarching architecture for education. And then the State Board of Education develops the rules and regulations to administer that, to carry that out. Now, the Constitution also provides that the legislature shall lay out the duties and responsibilities of the State Board of Education, which they have done. My clicker's no longer working. Okay. Here we are. So they've got the general supervision, and they promulgate rules and regulations. They have a series of more specific directives found at 115C-12. And a lot of these go to the money matters, so submitting a budget, apportionment of funds. There's information in there about refunds. And then they have the sort of standard miscellaneous powers and duties. We also have in North Carolina, just because anyway, I digress. I started to say something. So we have a superintendent of public instruction in North Carolina, and that's a statewide elected officer. It's a member of the Council of State, as I'm sure you're all aware. So what is it that the superintendent does? The superintendent is a constitutional officer created at Article 3, Section 7. Now, in North Carolina, our constitution is divided such that Article 1 is the Declaration of Rights. The Declaration of Rights in our constitution is more or less like the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution. There's more to it than that, but that's a sort of safe and convenient way to conceptualize it, that Article 1, Declaration of Rights, is roughly like the U.S. Bill of Rights. Article 2 lays out the legislative authority. Article 3 lays out executive. Article 4 lays out judicial. So Article 2 is executive branch officers, and that includes the superintendent. So she's elected every 4 years. The duties of that office are prescribed by law, and those duties are set in statute. The superintendent of public instruction acts as the secretary and chief administrative officer of the State Board of Education. The superintendent, quote, shall administer all needed rules and regulations adopted by the State Board of Education. And her details, or her duties, are detailed at 115C-21. And that splits them between administrative duties, which you'll see, it's a fairly lengthy list. And some of those things are exactly the kinds of things you would expect, things like reporting to the governor prior to legislative sessions, printing and distributing bulletins, administering through DPI, the needed rules and regulations is probably the most critical on her list of administrative duties. She also has duties as Secretary of the Board, and some of these are kind of standard secretarial duties for the secretary of an agency or body or commission, so things like maintaining the official records and the seal. If you've ever been secretary on a board of directors, you sort of know the rhythm of those duties and responsibilities. The superintendent is not, however, actually a member of the Board of Education and doesn't get to vote as a member of the Board of Education. That was subject to litigation back in 2009. And this is the first one of the cases that I'm going to talk about just very briefly. In 2009, the governor at the time created or attempted to create what she called a CEO of education. Okay. The then recently reelected superintendent, Dr. Atkinson, said, whoa, hold on, guys. This is respectfully, governor, you don't have the authority to do that. I'm a constitutional officer. So Dr. Atkinson, represented by the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law, I was one of the two attorneys for Dr. Atkinson in the case, full disclosure, she filed a lawsuit and said, this is unconstitutional. So it goes to Wake County Superior Court, and the court ultimately ruled in favor of Dr. Atkinson and wrote, the duties and responsibilities for administering and managing the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction and administering the North Carolina public school system as directed by the State Board of Education are vested in the duly elected State Superintendent of Public Instruction. So the court's analysis was, this is a constitutional officer. You can't take all of her duties and responsibilities and hand them to this newly created CEO figure. But the court also wrote, and this is important going forward to keep in the back of your minds if you're talking about how we want to reshape or how you may want to reshape education going forward. The court wrote, the state constitution does not prohibit the General Assembly from establishing a position that has the authority and power to administer the day-to-day operations of the DPI as designated by the State Board of Education, so long as legislation requires that such responsibilities be exercised through the Superintendent of Public Instruction or under her supervision. So that again gives this body or the legislature as a whole authority to create a position, but that position would have to be under the supervision and direction and control of the superintendent, or we would have to have a constitutional amendment. Now, this case, you'll notice it has a just a Superior Court case number. It doesn't have a cite to a Court of Appeals or Supreme Court. That's because the case wasn't appealed. After the court ruled in favor of Dr. Atkinson, said you're a constitutional officer and your constitutional duties and responsibilities can't be assigned to somebody else, Governor Perdue and the state at large opted not to appeal that. So the only direction or the most compelling direction we have on that front of a new kind of administrator position is this Superior Court decision. Before I dive into kind of the nuts and bolts on rules and rulemaking, I don't know if now would be a good time to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Shirley. Do you have a question?
I can always have one.
You're going to pass again. No questions from members of the committee. Excellent.
Okay. All right. All right, now we're moving on to the really sexy stuff, rulemaking. In North Carolina, rulemaking, we talk about rules, and rules and regulations are the same thing. People tend to hear the word rule and sometimes think that that's like a classroom rule or mom and dad's rules. It's not. It has an actual legal implication, a full legal definition. The process for promulgating rules and regulations in North Carolina is governed by the Administrative Procedures Act. That's what creates a framework for making rules. And it has two really fantastic attributes to commend it. One, it's transparent, right? It requires certain opportunities for public comment, for public notice of what rules and regulations are going to be, so that we're not creating, as a state, we aren't creating rules and regulations by ambush. Right? That's not the way the regulatory system should work. The other great thing is that it creates a diffuse system so that no one person and no one body is entirely responsible for the rulemaking process. Right? Part of that is that agencies adopt a rule, and then it goes to review at the Rules Review Commission. And then there's an opportunity for judicial review. So we have multiple, there's an opportunity for judicial rule review, and there's also an opportunity to send a rule back to the legislature. All it takes is 10 letters of objection, and a rule would go back to the legislature for the legislature to act how it deems fit. And we've had the APA, its first iteration came about in 1973. It was revised in 1986, and it's remained pretty much as is since 1986. So the APA requirements. The General Assembly has exercised its constitutional authority over the State Board of Education and DPI by further codifying the board's powers and subjecting it to the Administrative Procedures Act, including the APA's generally applicable regulations for adoption of agency rules. So the APA defines an agency as an agency or an officer of the executive branch of government of the state, and it includes the Council of State, which would include, of course, the superintendent, the governor's office, a board, a commission, a department, a division, a council, or any other unit of government in the executive branch. Now, under Article 2 of Chapter 150B, 150B is the Administrative Procedures Act, the adoption of an agency rule, and it states a rule is not valid, unless it is adopted in substantial compliance with this article, meaning the APA. So if an agency adopts a rule and does not do so in compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act, that rule is simply not valid. And that is as clear a sentence as I think I have ever read in a statute. A rule is not valid unless it is adopted in substantial compliance with this article. So the APA generally says, all right, this is the framework for making rules for all state agencies. It does exempt certain agencies. The State Board of Education is not one of the agencies that's been exempted. In fact, just to the contrary, the General Assembly expressly provided in 150C, that 115C, that's a typo, that the State Board of Education is subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. The statute states, all action of agencies taken pursuant to this chapter, the Elementary and Secondary Education chapter, as agency is defined in 150B2, is subject to the requirements of the Administrative Procedures Act. So not only was the State Board of Education not exempt from the standard rulemaking framework of the APA, the legislature specifically told State Board of Education, you are definitely subject to the APA rulemaking process. There is at least one, I think only one, exception to that, at 115C-270.15B regarding certain personnel evaluation metrics. My research revealed no other areas where State Board of Education has been exempted from the rulemaking process. I can't guarantee that there isn't one. This is the only one my research has revealed in the few years I've been looking at it. So I think it's safe to say this is, if not the only one, certainly one of maybe a couple. So generally speaking, State Board of Education rules have to go through the rulemaking process. Now, sometimes we hear these questions about what's the difference between a rule and a policy, right? I'm sure a few of you have had that question, scratch your head about it. So we also know that the State Board and some other various agencies throughout state government will sometimes try to circumvent the rulemaking process, which can be cumbersome because that's how we guarantee both transparency and diffuse rulemaking. So the APA tells us that a rule is any agency regulation, standard, or statement of general applicability that implements or interprets an enactment of the General Assembly or Congress or a regulation adopted by a federal agency or that describes the procedure or practice requirements of an agency. The term includes the establishment of a fee and the amendment or repeal of a prior rule. So any agency regulation, standard, or statement of general applicability that implements or interprets an enactment of the General Assembly. So anything that the State Board of Education or any other non-exempt agency is putting out there, whatever they want to call it, if it implements an enactment of the General Assembly, if it implements a statute, it's a rule. And we know that a rule isn't valid unless it's promulgated in compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act. Again, that's a very clear sentence. A rule is not valid unless adopted in substantial compliance with the APA. So the APA doesn't define a policy, but it does warn us this. And this, again, direct quote from a statute, an agency shall not seek to implement or enforce against any person a policy, guideline, or other interpretive statement that meets the definition of a rule contained in 150B if the policy, guideline, or other interpretive statement has not been adopted as a rule in accordance with this article. It doesn't matter what they call it. They can call it anything they want. They can call it a policy. They can call it a guideline. If it meets the statutory definition of a rule, it's not valid if it's not passed in substantial compliance with the APA. Does anyone have any questions about that at this point?
Representative Blackwell.
Are you through with that section on difference between rules and policies?
Unless you have some more questions
right,
about it.
Yeah, okay.
There are some cases I could talk about that might be useful for you.
The exception that was enacted into law for testing and I think teacher evaluations or something.
Mm-hmm.
When was that enacted? And do you know what the thinking was as to why that was accepted?
I do not know when it was enacted. And I believe just from the language of it regarding personnel matrix that it was probably prompted by concerns about the need for flexibility on personnel matters. It could have been prompted by a teacher shortage. It could have been prompted just by a change in policy. But I don't know when that particular exemption was enacted.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if staff possibly knows when that particular exception was.
If they don't have it readily available, I'm sure they can come up with it.
Yeah, we can.
Okay. All right. Do you mind if they dig around?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative.
A different question, okay. If I may. I think you also said that the Administrative Procedures Act applied to whatever fell into this category of rule or whatever, of general applicability. What does that mean? Can the agency, in effect, avoid applicability of the APA by purporting to limit it so that it is not generally applicable?
I think part of that is, I mean, people will try whatever they want to try, right? It's sort of like when I was actively practicing and a client would ask, could we sue over this? Well, you can sue. Can you win is the better question. So in terms of trying to circumvent the APA rulemaking process by trying to circumscribe a rule and say it's not generally applicable, I think the standard evaluation of what constitutes generally applicable would be something that's imposed on outside groups as opposed to something to be contradistinguished from, say, internal operations that don't affect anybody on the outside. And those are things like internal operating procedures about, say, who has to get clearance to make copies on the copier, those sorts of internal policies that only govern inside and don't apply to the outside world. Those would be different from a rule, but I think anything that's being pushed out to the outside world is going to be subject to the definition of a rule.
One final question, then I'll yield to others. I want to talk about the practicality of challenging, let us say, the state board or failure to follow the APA. There seems to be pretty clear. There was language about they shall not do this, and if they don't do this, it's void or ineffective. But we're all aware, I think, of circumstances in which the pressure of those circumstances may cause people to be reluctant to challenge that which may not be in accord with the procedures required for APA. So does it fall to parents or local boards of education to file lawsuits, or is there some entity that on behalf of those folks, can your Rules Review Commission, in effect, raise a challenge to something that didn't comply with the rules, or do you have to wait and have your ability to do something triggered by others?
Okay, so there are a couple of – I'm going to unpack that a little bit, if you don't mind. So after a rule gets promulgated by an agency, the way it's supposed to work is that then it goes to the Rules Review Commission. And the Rules Review Commission votes to approve or not approve a rule and has a very circumscribed role. It only reviews for four things. It is specifically precluded by statute from considering the efficacy of a rule, right? Rules Review Commission does not get into the policy. The Rules Review Commission reviews for statutory authority, clarity, necessity, and compliance with the APA. That's it. Those four things. Now, if the commission approves a rule, people can object to that. It only takes 10 letters of objection, and the rule ends up back at the legislature. Right? And those 10 letters of objection can come from anybody in the state, parents, nonprofit organization, advocates. It could be anybody. Any 10 people, and it gets legislative review. And then it's back with you guys. If the Rules Review Commission says, no, you don't have statutory authority, or you didn't comply with the APA because you didn't satisfy the requisite periods of public comment, for example, or you didn't get a fiscal note when you needed one, then it goes, then the rule sort of shifts back to the agency, and they can revise a rule. They'll sometimes ask for a fiscal note if that's what's missing, et cetera. Yes, sir.
Excuse me for interrupting. I may not have made my question clear. I think I sort of generally understand how the process works once you get into it. I think my question has to do with what if the agency says this isn't a rule? What if the agency says we don't have to adopt a rule, and they're doing something, and how do you raise the issue of you've got to adopt, you've got to call it a rule, it is a rule, you've got to go through the process, you can't say that you don't.
Okay. To that, I thought at one point you'd asked if the RRC does anything, because the RRC doesn't. Like, they review the rules and that's where their duty ends. If you've got someone out there saying, this is a rule, you didn't go through the APA, they could seek a declaratory judgment, which is they walk into court and they ask a judge to say, this is not a rule because you didn't pass it in compliance. Or they simply don't comply with it and go back and say, we didn't have to comply with that. Right? We also know that the State Board of Education sued the state and the RRC a few years ago, saying that they didn't have to go through the rulemaking process, and the Supreme Court decided that. And I'm happy to talk about that, but in that case, the state Supreme Court walked us through, and it was a 5-2 decision. So it was not a party line decision, I might add. So in that decision, the state Supreme Court walked us through the history of the authority of the legislature, the history of the State Board of Education, and said very clearly, you know, State Board of Education, like it or not, you're subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, because what you do is, under the Constitution, subject to the laws enacted by the General Assembly, and among those laws is the APA. So we already have a Supreme Court decision that is very clear that the agency in question, State Board of Education, has to comply with the APA. Now, if they're not doing that, one of the mechanisms to remedy that would be a declaratory judgment invalidating or declaring invalid one of their so-called policies, or it could be a defense in some kind of noncompliance action saying we didn't have to comply. Yes, sir.
But who has standing to bring such a declaratory judgment action? Is there any state entity that can do that on behalf of what I'll call the public, or does that mean that a local education, public school unit, whatever it's currently called, or parents have to hire lawyers, raise money, spend money from their sources to raise the question?
Standing is a wickedly complex area. I would say if you've got anybody who's directly impacted by it, which could be, I mean, it could be a local school board. They have brought various actions in their own right over the years over a number of different aspects. Could be that. I think with the Declaratory Judgment Act, I think there's certainly a very good argument to be made that parents, on behalf of their children who are affected, could bring the action. They would have an interest under our existing standing rubrics on constitutionality and constitutional standing and taxpayer standing. I think they probably could. I do think it's probably something that would be raised as a defense by the state board. Certainly, were I representing the state board, that's something that I think would be considered.
Representative Willis.
Thank you for all the information so far. You mentioned earlier that you had some examples maybe you could walk through rather than just the slides. Could you give us some real-life examples?
Sure thing. Real-life examples of?
Just in terms of the rulemaking and the policies and maybe where, you know, why some of these were made or if there were, you know, actions that required it to be made or clarified or something.
Okay, so we've got, I mean, there are a couple of cases that I think are kind of interesting and important to keep in mind when we're talking about sort of this division between the legislature and State Board of Education, also with respect to local governments. So we have a case from the early 1980s, Whittle Communication. And in it, we had the State Board of Education, who brought a lawsuit saying they didn't want local governments to be able to contract over this new service that was being brought into schools. It's called Channel One. I remember watching it when I was a kid. It was this news thing they brought into the schools every morning. State Board of Education, those contracts were as between the Channel One provider, the news source provider, and local government. The State Board of Education didn't like that, and they brought this lawsuit. So it percolates, as these things tend to, up to the Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said the General Assembly already delegated authority for selecting secondary education materials to the local school boards. Because the General Assembly has spoken in this area, State Board, go home. Local governments, the local school boards get to enter into these contracts. They have specific statutory authority to do it. That's that's a space in which the legislature affirmatively and specifically spoke to the issue at hand. If we go back a few years in time to the 1970s, we had a case called Guthrie. And in Guthrie, we had a teacher who challenged rules that had been promulgated by the State Board of Education with regard to certification, teacher certification. And in that case, the Supreme Court said the State Board is allowed to promulgate these rules because the General Assembly didn't say anything. You know, the General Assembly was silent on this issue. This is, of course, decades ago. General Assembly was silent on this issue, and so State Board of Education gets to make its rules. Because there was, as the court noted, silence from the General Assembly. So once, if the legislature leaves an area quiet, which is pretty rare, I'll be honest, if the General Assembly is quiet about something, then the State Board of Education can promulgate its rules how it wants. You know, it needs to procedurally comply with the APA, but the actual substance of it is left to the State Board of Education. That's in contrast with that Channel 1 case I just mentioned, Whittle, where the General Assembly spoke, and what it said was, we're leaving this to the locals. So you've got two cases that explain, you know, there's a big difference between silence and a specific directive, even if it's a narrow specific directive.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Willis.
Have there been any cases where, either through the court system or the challenges attempted, that would, challenge the General Assembly's authority in any of the rulemaking or the policies, therefore, by the board or by the department or anyone else?
Well, that State Board of Education lawsuit over the APA, that was really a wide assault on the General Assembly's authority. In fact, there were seven claims initially brought in that, one of which was this kind of exotic argument that the State Board of Education was somehow not part of the executive or legislative branch, and the State Board of Education is just stuck doing whatever they're going to do, subject to any law that the General Assembly enacts. In this particular case, the General Assembly enacted the APA, but generally speaking, you're subject to the laws of the General Assembly. So we don't have a lot of other cases. I think because that case was so profoundly clear, it's a spectacular majority opinion written by Justice Morgan.
One last question, Mr. Yes, Chair. And I guess then the reverse of that, have there been any cases where the General Assembly has had to challenge the authority of the school board in certain issues?
Not that I know of. But I don't know of every single case out there. So,
any additional questions from members of the committee? Representative Blackwell.
If I may, I would like to go back. I would like to go back to
what I think is maybe a constitutional or statutory question, if I can do that,
certainly,
please. The charge of the committee is to essentially deal with K-12 education.
Yes, sir.
However, K-12 education involves teachers who are trained to become teachers in higher ed. What are the constitutional provisions that govern the legislature's ability to impose, let us say, requirements or conditions or something on higher ed as it relates to preparation of teachers for K-12 schools? Where do we go to get authority to do that? If we have it, is it restricted?
Right.
What are the parameters on that?
I would advise this. I think you can constitutionally do it with you're instead of trying to regulate what's coming out of the university system in teacher preparation, it would probably be a sounder approach to regulate who is allowed to teach, who's certified to teach, who's qualified to teach, who can be hired, so that, which also as a matter of policy would capture anyone who's trained outside of North Carolina. You know, you have somebody who goes to University of South Carolina for college and wants to teach in North Carolina. You would certainly want to make sure that you're capturing that pool of teachers. So probably the most effective way to go about doing what you would want, what it sounds like you would be interested in doing, is, and certainly a constitutional way to do it, would be to revise your statutes on teacher qualifications, because that would definitely be under your elementary and secondary authority. Now, there are provisions in the state constitution regarding higher ed, but I think there isn't anything that would limit you in terms of what you could do to establish minimum qualifications for teachers in elementary and secondary schools.
One follow-up. For some reason, I was thinking there was some authority somewhere that, other than the indirect approach that you suggest, is we won't hire people unless they've got this, and the schools don't want to train people that can't get hired, so they do it. But you're saying we can't, for example, require UNC Greensboro School of Education to offer certain types of courses or minimum hours or anything that would impact what's actually delivered as a part of the instructional process there for teacher preparation.
I'm not saying that you couldn't do that. I am saying it's probably not going to capture everybody that you want to capture. It wouldn't capture people who are studying out of state. It wouldn't capture people who study at private universities and colleges. I don't think that it's that you couldn't set those standards for the UNC system, for the state-funded system. It's that that's probably not as effective, and it's probably going to get you into a little more of a conflict on how the university is structured in terms of curricula independence and Senate faculty pushback and a whole host of both legal and policy issues that could very easily be avoided by going in to the direct route of establishing what the teacher qualifications are for the K-12 system.
Can I ask one question of staff on this topic? I can't remember what it's called, but it seems to me a few years back that we've got a board, professional standards board or something like that. Is that board's function exclusively to set requirements for getting into the profession as an employee, or does the board have some ability to impose requirements directly on higher ed?
Brian Gwynn, Legislative Analysis. So, Representative Blackwell, I believe you're referring to the Pepsi Professional Educator Preparation and Standards Commission. It's largely has an advisory role, but it covers everything related to educator preparation and teacher licensure. There is a process by which the recommendations of Pepsi go up to the state board, and the state board can determine whether or not it accepts or rejects the recommendations. But they start as in an advisory role, and they do cover everything. Their purview can cover everything related to educator preparation, including the types of requirements that a teacher might have to study and learn in an EPP in order for the state to actually recognize the EPP, the Educator Preparation Program. And so the way it works in North Carolina is that in order for a teacher to be licensed, they have to go to an approved EPP. And so the state board has the authority to determine which EPPs are actually approved. And so that is how the General Assembly has, up to this point, elected to provide certain requirements in statute on EPPs, basically saying the state board must factor in this criteria and set these certain minimum requirements for an EPP in order for an EPP to be approved. Otherwise, a student could go to it, and then they wouldn't actually get they ultimately would not – it would not lead to licensure. I'm happy to go into a little bit more detail if I can, but sure.
And if I may follow up on that, I suspect it's structured that way, where the control is at the licensure end as opposed to the teacher's college-level training. It has, I think, pretty much always been that the control is through certification and minimum employment standards once they've actually finished their university.
And I'm going to jump in front of this one, too. Brian, would you please put them on a list of future presenters and have them come explain?
Yeah, yes,
that group. Thank you. Any additional questions from members of committee? Did you have anything you'd like to add?
Just that there are a few other constitutional provisions that I think are noted at the end of the presentation. You've got some information, cites to the taxing authority, tax or restrictions on the drawing of funds. Some of that goes back to litigation that we've had, Richmond County Board of Education, we've had Leandro and Hoke, and we've got a number of other cases out there, none of which were really under the umbrella of my presentation today, but there are a few slides in there. I am happy to talk with any of you or any of your fellow representatives. If you have questions, feel free to call me or email me. I have attached my business card to the pocket copies of the Constitution you have. If you'd ever like me back to present on something else, I'm happy to do so, or happy to take phone calls or emails. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your interest in the North Carolina Constitution.
Thank you. We should all be more interested in the North Carolina Constitution. We're going to ask you, I don't know, you're free to leave if you want to, but if you'd like to hang out with us for a while in case another question pops up.
Sure thing.
We're here till about 3 o'clock, so thank you for your presentation, and then we'll move on.
Thank you.
Now, why did we hear about our Constitution policy requirements? Number one, if we venture down this road, we kind of got to know what fence to stay in. We have to have the boundaries marked. That way we run into least obstacles and hurdles. And I'm going to rely heavily on staff as we go on this journey, that if we often talk about something, maybe future, can we do this, would it be constitutional, would it be rulemaking, would it be general statute, and it would kind of give us a differentiate between what would be required. So once we understand, which we got a good dose of that today, and as we move further afield, we'll get more information relative to how each of these impact where it would need to go inside the historical documents of North Carolina, be it Constitution, general statute, rules, or policymaking. With that, we're going to move into open discussion. Does anyone need a pause for 3 to 5 minutes? If not, we'll move right into it. Seeing none. What I'd like y'all, sent you an email, is to help express some just general thoughts on if the world was according to you today in education, what would we do or what would you do to help create a process to educate children in North Carolina to best be able to accommodate their needs once they exit whatever level of education, whether it be high school education, moving into a job, or whether it be a school of higher learning. How would be the best way to have our kids prepared? And just to break the ice, I'll throw a couple out there for you that I've often wondered about and give you just a brief synopsis of my, I guess, history of education. Of course, being a dad, which is not the qualifier, but it often helps, of a child that went through the public education system. Also, being PTO president of each one of her schools, except her high school, was very involved with the education process within each and every school she went through. And then also being a county commissioner for 8 years, I got to see the financial back part, the back scene of the financial part of local education, not state funding, but at least local education. Primarily focused on infrastructure, vertical schools, and the like. So I have a pretty good dose of education over the last 26 years. I'm learning something new each and every day. But I've often wondered, for example, just off the top of my head, because you're a certain age, why are you in a certain grade? When that really has absolutely nothing to do with your ability to learn, speed of your ability to learn, or anything, just because you're a certain age. And I do understand often the stigma attached between young and old students in the same classroom. It's not the Wild West anymore where everybody goes to the one-room schoolhouse and you got kindergartners and college students sitting around the warm morning stove getting their lessons from the school marm. I mean, I understand we've advanced from there. But I often wonder what it is that dictates because you're a certain age, therefore you must be in a certain grade, other than a system that decided that some time ago. Each and every year we have discussions around calendar. Remember those discussions we've had every year since I've been here? I think this is the 12th year I've been here, and each and every year we have in-depth, long hours of man hours lost discussions of calendars. Why don't we just fix that issue and check the box and move on to other issues? So those are just two of the things that I have thought of as well. One relative specific to instructional time, or two rather. Have we, over the years, offloaded too much responsibility other than just teaching responsibility to teachers in the classroom? Are they doing much more than whatever was required of a teacher some years ago? And is it time now that perhaps we separate and hire additional people for that school to do the things that teachers are now obligated to do to allow them to focus back on teaching? I mean, there's all kinds of, if you think of it from a business aspect, you can look at it, through that lens, if you would, of providing aid and assistance to classroom instructional personnel, being the teachers. My focus on this committee is to focus on three, what I call the trifecta of education. That's the parent and the student and the teacher. So you can see that's the classroom atmosphere. And provide the primary focus on that, then leadership for that, and then everyone else from the support aspect to provide. But that's just some of the ideas I've had I'd like to look into, and I'd like to broach that with you guys to step up and provide some. So I know you all have thought about it, because I know you have the same people contacting you that contact me about their concerns about education. Even pretty much, if COVID has taught us one thing, it's, I think, with the online instructional capability and the lost kids in North Carolina that just never showed up, I think it's opened the eyes of concern for more people like us to aid and assist to get a good outcome for the kids throughout North Carolina. I'll be quiet momentarily and offer if there's any ideas. And Harry, you're welcome to join in the conversation. Representative Zinger.
Thank you. So let me start by saying I raised four kids.
God love you.
5.5 years between the top and the bottom. And two things that I learned. The biggest thing that just kind of blew me away, they were all brought up exactly the same. Lived in the same house the entire time. We didn't even change addresses. And the difference in each one of these kids is unbelievable. You know, I just figured, well, they'll all be brought up the same, they'll be the same. Nope, not even close. And so over that period of time, my wife and I used the public education system, we used private system, we homeschooled, we used magnet schools, and we used the dual enrollment in the community college system. And the reason that was is that we recognized different kids had different gifts and talents and interests. And we also, our overarching philosophy was we need to prepare these kids. What is education for? We're preparing them to be able to live on their own, to be able to go do their own thing and to excel at what they're doing. One of the things that I think has evolved, I don't know that this is anybody's fault, but you're talking about a huge system, but we've got a lot of one-size-fits-all. It just doesn't work. And we see kids, I should preface that I did urban ministry for 13 years with young people in Baltimore City, so I was very involved with the school system there. But one of the problems is we're not, I feel like not providing enough opportunity for kids to be different and to go do some of those, to explore some of those different things. We're getting better at that, you know. And so my point to all of this is I think that we need to get back to understanding that the primary purpose of education is to equip these folks to be good adults. And I think that that sometimes gets lost with some of these other issues. The other thing we need to recommend is not every kid is going to be college bound. Not every kid is going to go to law school. Not every kid, but you know what, at the same time, some of them are going to be diesel mechanics, and some of them are going to be, you know, other tradesmen. And so, and then how do we make it so that it's not an all or none thing, that there's options and avenues for these kids to do it? The last thing is I think we have greatly failed our kids with financial literacy. We spent a lot of time with our kids to make sure that they understood that, but I can just tell you with their friends and some of their, and when they go off to college and we see some of the folks they're associated with, they have absolutely no idea of anything with financial literacy. So that's kind of a hodgepodge of what I learned in 25 years of wide open.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having gone to school a long time ago, I have noticed how things have changed, and not so much for the better. Children today, many of them cannot read, write, spell, give change. And I hear this from many people. They certainly can't sign their names, and I've tried to correct that, but that hasn't worked so far. I want to see that happen, if there's any way we can get that done. Many things that were worked then, would work again now. We had discipline. We had respect for each other and for ourselves. We cared about one another. Most of us, I understand, had two parents at home, though, and today that has changed because of divorce and many other things. I think we need to look at the child. We need to help the child, and I think we need a dedicated, trained, correctly teacher in each class. I think that is the number one way to train to get the children to be a success. They're going to have teachers who care, and who care if they get it. I mean, some kids are just not getting it, and they're not taking the time. Testing is not going to always tell this, because a lot of children test different ways. We have got to do life skills. The children are not getting it. Students are not getting it. Other places, and we have got to this, and I understand this is very important in the jobs that are open today, that the life skills have not been taught in grammar school, high school, or college, community college, either way, and we've got to get to this. I care if what is working in our schools. I care to know what is working, what is not working. If our money is going to something that is not working, I think we need to look at that and say, okay, we need to put this money somewhere else. Because, you know, and I don't know what they are. We have several nonprofits. We have several for-profits in our schools. But I think we need to know what they are doing and how they're affecting our children. I think that we need to know this. I'm looking forward. I'm excited about the intent of this committee. I'm excited about what we're going to hear from the people out here. And I'm hoping we have a good outcome. And I hope that we can make a difference in our students' lives with this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would concur both with Representative Hurley and Representative Zinger. I think a lot of where we're at today in terms of education has the needs of the children has changed significantly. And I think it's a societal shift as well. I saw a chart a while back that showed what a student in the early 1900s would have known coming out of what was equivalent to the eighth grade at that point and what our kids coming out of high school know now. And there was a significant gap in the knowledge that our children now would have had versus an eighth grader then. And so I think a lot of it goes back to literacy and what we look at. We know we've been failing our kids in terms of their ability to read at the end of third grade on an effective level for years. It's not a COVID-related issue. This has been ongoing for years. And then we know after third grade, it shifts from learning to read to reading to, you know, to learn. And if a child is behind at that point, they're never going to catch up. and we don't have effective programs to help them catch up, by and large. And the other side, we've got parents who have abdicated their responsibility far too often to the schools now. I mean, I've heard parents specifically say, it's not my job to educate my child. That's why I send them to school. And I think we have to go back to understanding what the parents' responsibilities actually are. The parent should be the number one advocate, the number one teacher for their child. Now, they may not be the math specialist or the literacy specialist, but in terms of rearing and raising and educating their child and preparing them for life, it really should be a parent's responsibility. And so the point made earlier, I think, is well noted that, you know, our teachers today and for a long time have been asked to take on more and more responsibilities. They're asked to play nursemaid. They're asked to play parent. They're asked to play psychologist. They're asked to, you know, so many different roles beyond what they're learning and being prepared for in the university system that a lot of these folks, you know, aren't really skilled to do to that point. And I mean, they do a fantastic job, trying to help these children and to do the best they can. But I think we've got to get back to understanding what the role and responsibility of the teachers are, what the role and responsibilities of parents are. There has to be parental accountability reestablished to some level for this to be successful. And I think we really have to understand, and I think Representative Zinger mentioned it earlier, I mean, what is the role of education? And if it's to prepare a student or a child for life and a career to be a successful an adult, what does that look like? And what are those responsibilities? Now, if they've changed, then, you know, maybe we need to go back and look at the curricula that's being taught and how that's affecting them. Are they prepared? Is a student who walks across the stage and receives a diploma after graduating high school prepared to go out, and do they have the basic skills they need to get a job? And you know, we know there's a shortage of skilled labor across the state. That's not going to stop. We've got to take a look at what our employers are looking for, what the needs are of those children at that point in time, and then how do we help them get there? I think your point was very well noted earlier. Why do we have these arbitrary grade levels that we know aren't working for a lot of our students? This one-size-fits-all approach to many students doesn't work. We've got an increasing number of children that are on the spectrum. We've got an increasing number of children that have, attention deficit issues. And the way that these children learn isn't necessarily the same. And we can't expect them to sit still and to do that. And we know there's plenty of data and research out there that shows these children are able and effective learners, but it has to be done in a way that fits their individual needs. And so we've got to find a way to break out of the mold that we're in right now and meet these children where they're at if we want this to be successful going forward. So thank you.
Ms. Chairman, I don't really disagree with a lot of the observations that have already been made, but trying to look maybe a little bit more broadly at what I understood the committee's charge to be is, we're looking at an education system for the future. And I think a system is more than a collection of different programs and policies that we may emphasize or de-emphasize from time to time. And the two things systemically that I would hope we will talk about, look at while we're doing this work, first has to do with leadership. I think that impacts whatever you want done, whether it's financial literacy, whether it's basic reading and math skills. If you don't have the right leaders with vision and skills to lead others in place, then most of the great ideas may not end up being put into place effectively. At this point, it seems to me, and I felt this way when I first came to the legislature. In fact, I had legislation drafted back then, but it didn't go anywhere. To make the state superintendent of public instruction the head of the state board of education. In that way, you don't end up with the sort of double-headed situation that we've got currently. I'd also take a look at whether we ought to maybe consider electing members to the state board of education. The reason I suggest that is we don't need a system in which a governor with different views controls a majority of the board, and the superintendent, even if he or she were chair of the state board, is outvoted by people who have different policies. If the voters are going to elect the superintendent, we might could elect from districts members of the state board with the idea that the public could then become the arbiter of whether that leadership was being effective in ways that voters and parents felt that it should be. So I hope we'll take a look at that constitutional organizational structure there. The second thing I want to mention that I think is really a systemic observation is something that didn't exist back when the last constitutional amendments were adopted, and that is the computer world. I don't believe for a moment that computers can teach our kids effectively without the interaction of teachers and other education leaders. But I do think they are tools that can do a lot for us, especially if we're talking about meeting the needs of individual students. We have a resource now that can assess an individual student so that the teacher can see who needs what and how they're moving along. And I'm excited that the DPI currently and Superintendent Truitt apparently is continuing to pursue the task of competency-based education. Computers open up that avenue of doing a more individualized instruction for students, whatever they may need. But the other aspect of computers is that if we're going to focus on student outcomes, not the satisfaction of educators with the profession, not the satisfaction of other folks, but if we're going to look at, are students doing better where they need to do better? Are they reading effectively? Are they in a position to compete effectively with other areas of the world? Our advanced students test more poorly than the advanced students in other areas of the world. Everybody's familiar with the longstanding achievement gap we've got in North Carolina and across the country, frankly, that's been there for 40 or 50 years. As a part of our new system, there needs to be some sort of devotion to taking advantage of the data that computers can provide us on a real-time basis, really, to move the needle forward. And if it's not moving, stop doing what you were doing that doesn't work and do something differently. And I think that also means as we look at how we organize that data, what data we collect, and what tells us whether it's really working or not, we need some sort of independent audit of that data. We don't need to ask DPI, how are you folks doing? Tell us what your data says. It's almost like we need an independent audit, sort of like Beth Wood goes into various agencies and does an independent audit, but it's not her office that she's auditing or telling us about. So I would just encourage us to take a way at the leadership of education in the state is currently structured constitutionally and to make some changes in the area of using data to actually do the best job of impacting student outcomes.
Thank you for that. Any other comments from members of the committee? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for putting me on this committee. I'm excited about the work we can do. I think we can make a big difference in North Carolina. I'm happy to hear from everyone, especially your views as parents. I, too, am a parent of two children, and one of the things that we did have when my children were in elementary school were multi-age classes. So that sort of talks about what you spoke about, Chairman. And that was based on Gardner's theory of intelligences, which I encourage everyone to look up. Some of the things I want to talk about come from the Huntley Committee, the Huntley Commission. We know that is a bicameral commission, which is looking at access, funding, structure, and alignment and transitions, and they're going to spend 6 months doing that. One of the things that they've come up with, I like to start at the very beginning. So when children are born, we know that sometimes parents need help, especially if it's a single-parent household. We have things in the state like family connections and the nurse family partnerships that sends people into the homes to try to help the parent learn how to be a parent. I think that's extremely helpful, and we need to expand the access to that. Then there are things like Smart Start and More at Four that help children learn the things that they need to learn before they get to kindergarten, so they'll be ready to learn once they're in kindergarten. Lately, there has been some developments in that area for children who do not make the cutoff. If they're on a waiting list, especially in rural areas, Edgecombe County is doing something that is very innovative called the Early Learning Network that allows children to meet in pods in libraries or community centers with their families once or twice a week to practice being together as a group, sitting down, listening to someone read, putting on their listening ears, that sort of thing. So that's very innovative. That's happening right now in Edgecombe County. We need to expand that to the rest of the state. And then once children get to school, what do we need? We know we need people that have talent in positions such as principal and teachers. We know that things like the Teaching Fellows Program, expanded teaching roles, having principal leadership programs, are very, very important and help develop these roles and people to be in them. We have to invest in those positions. We also know, especially since COVID, that counselors, nurses, and social workers are very, very important and necessary, and children have great needs, even greater now than they did before. We also know that teacher assistants help in the classroom. They take some of the burden off the teachers. We need to add them back in. So those are some of the things I'm interested in. We can make this system better in North Carolina. We know how to do it. We have a variety of groups doing great things in North Carolina, like Best NC and the Huntley Commission, and we can take all their data and make it make a real difference in the lives of parents and teachers and students. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I can't help but notice the Huntley, the Hunt. Is there anything with that, any relation? Thank you for being here. Thank you for your comments. Did I see anyone else, members of the committee? Representative Farkas.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, thank you for service opportunity on this committee. I'll just quickly say that, you know, my interest, I'm a product of public schools all the way through. And my brother's a teacher at a public magnet school here in Wake County. And it's amazing to hear the stories that he tells every day and the difficulties that he faces, but it's incredibly rewarding work, and I'm in awe of people like him and teachers across the area. And having grown up in a place in eastern North Carolina where, you know, even in the private sector and the work I do, you can see the disproportionate level of investment, and depending on the county, depending on the access to good teachers. And we've really got to, particularly in our rural areas, look at what kind of, you know, regional approaches we can bring to bear. And conversation about making sure public education and that access is getting where it needs to be. To Representative Hunt's point, the teacher pipeline is an issue that I definitely would love to see tackled head on. I think she mentioned some good points already with the Teaching Fellows Program, the reinstatement of master's pay. How do we really inspire the next generation of such a critical workforce, that the number one determinant of success in a child's life is the educator, the teacher that's in the room with them? How do we double down on that and make sure that teachers who are in the field see the and recognize that we see their talent, we recognize that we want to reward it and incentivize the best and the brightest to stay here? How do we do that? What's the best way to do it within the public schools? And then one other side, and again, this is probably more my perspective in the design construction industry, is the facilities and the spaces that we're putting these students in. Again, being in and out of a rural area, we've seen schools that I've seen schools where the gyms can't be opened. Because the floors of the foundations are having major issues, you know, water's coming through our ceilings. How do we have conversations about those facilities so that regardless of whether you're in one of our bigger cities, you're out in a rural area, you're living in a place that truly fosters learning and is productive? I mean, the studies back us up clearly on just even the basic use of daylighting in a building and what that can do for a student in terms of just natural productivity. I'd love to see us talk a little bit more about that, how we're driving funds towards those major facilities investments, because I think they really do make a meaningful difference. Thank you.
I could have used you back in my first grade. Miss Pitzer made us all turn around away from the window because that was a distraction. Any additional comments by members of the committee? I would also like, on behalf of Representative Shepherd, who is a member of this committee. He had a funeral to take care of from a member of his church today, so he called in. Unfortunately, he would not be able to be here. And also Representative Brockman, who is a member of this committee, has self-quarantined. So we'll keep all those in our prayers for their needs. I'd like to also mention one thing that we talked about off and on, and it's actually in the Constitution. It's not talked about very much, but just for the sake of addressing a constitutional requirement of education, on page 83 of your book, which is Article 9, Section 1, Education Encourages, the heading, and it says, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools, libraries, and means of education shall forever be encouraged. And you just don't hear that often. I thought that to begin that Article 9, I think that was a very good statement issued by some of our, we'll say, forefathers, for the lack of a better term. Would also make a few comments. We are noting pretty much everything you said. We had already talked about we will bring business and industry in to provide their perception of what they would think a good education system of a potential workforce coming out might be. Granted, we're not here to hire, you know, to train workers. We're here to educate students. But also, it's best on their behalf if they are properly prepared with the knowledge needed to go out and earn enough above a living wage, the best they could possibly do, to give them that ability. And I think we have the folks in this room that can pull that off and make that happen. We are going to talk to them. We are going to bring in teachers. We will be taking some junkets across the state to certain areas to see what's working and maybe even some that see what's not working. We have to define the difference, or we have to differentiate between what is working and what's not working. I think Representative Hurley hit on it, that if we are exercising the expenditures of the people's tax money in such a broad thing as we are, education nearing almost 60% of our gross or total budget, and I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we're getting the biggest bang for our buck and making sure that if we say we're going to have kids reading when they exit grade 3, by golly, they're reading when they exit grade 3. And if they're in the ninth grade, they're reading at a ninth grade level. Not if they're in the 12th grade, reading at a ninth grade level. Different people have different listings, but if you look at pretty much your major publications, they'll say that the United States is currently somewhere around 25th or 26th globally in education. I don't know about you guys, but I intend to have North Carolina do a whole lot better than that. We not only are we the friendliest military state, but we're the education state, too, and we can do a lot better in 25th, 26th globally as a country, much less just in North Carolina singularly. I've often said, and I'll use this I've said it in transportation, I use it in education as well, is that, you know, my concern is not the mountain or the sea or the middle part of North Carolina. It's us against the other 49, and that's how we need to approach this, and we can have our kids the best and the brightest. It's going to be a long haul. I've talked to the speaker and told him it'd probably be a 2-year effort. But just to put y'all's thoughts into it is that we will be rolling up into a short session, we believe, at some point in time. So if there is potential legislation that may start to come up from this committee and you want to enter that, prepare that for short session, that's fine. We will have an interim report as short session gets here probably in May, June, or July, we're assuming. And so we will be doing that. But I would think any weighty or meaty legislation would be a collaborative and a compilation of work at the end of the duties of this committee, which is probably about, I'd say, at least a year to 2 years down the road. We have bitten off a very, very broad subject. Like I said, it is the largest budget subject in the state of North Carolina. There's a lot of work to be done. It's a 100-year-old system that we're looking into, and we will just do the best. And if you have any ideas or suggestions or specifics that you'd like the committee to take and look into, please do not hesitate to bring them to either one of my chairs or myself, and we will get that lined up. We are currently going to plan on meeting on February 7th at 1 p.m. in this very room. The next stage of this will be hearing from Superintendent Truitt. We are trying to line up the next meeting, which I believe is the 21st, where we're trying to, at this point, to get the chair of the school board here to understand their duties and responsibilities from both the superintendent and the board, as well as have additional commentary and conference between members of the committee as to what perhaps next steps and who you'd like to see and get on the docket and get them in front of us to hear and make our go. People have asked me about this committee and other than telling them that if we were didn't have an education committee and we need to create one, what would one look like? That's pretty much what we're here for. Do I have any goal in mind where I want to be a certain time? And the answer is absolutely not. But y'all know sometimes a committee is formed to, I guess, cement a purpose or a goal that's already been determined. This is not one of those committees. This is truly a start with the foundation and start building a framework and eventually put a roof and some great shingles on top of that roof to last for 100 years. And that would be the education system. We've learned a tremendous amount from COVID. We are continuing to learn from COVID. Representative Blackwell pinged on the idea of bringing more technology through the data acquisition of data in real-time availability. That's off-the-shelf stuff now, folks. That's not Einstein or rocket science. That's stuff that's available to each and every one of us right now, and we need to utilize as much of that as we possibly can to aid and assist in the education process of our kids. With that, unless there is anything else, I'd like to thank our presenter again. Thank you. And we have your number, and don't be if someone calls you and says, hey, we need you, so be on alert. So.
Always happy to help.
Yes, Representative Hunt, for a question. Yes, ma'am.
I would just like to ask, if possible, to get the materials or the agenda as early as possible. I'd like to read everything before the meeting.
Okay, that's absolutely right. And Brian has, and he said I should do this. I almost forgot, but I'll do it now. It was the will of the chair to be paperless. However, what that is that when the documents have been received, you also have the ability to ask your legislative assistant, if you so choose, to have those printed and ready for you to come to committee. And we will do everything we can to have those as early as we possibly can. Sometimes it also just, I'm sure you know this, but just for the people listening, sometimes it's, we're kind of weight of the the presenters. This was not the case today, but sometimes they don't get the information here in what we'd like to see as a more timely fashion. So that sometimes is kind of restrictive on when we're able to release stuff, but we will do the very best we possibly can. Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we possibly have just a snapshot of our individual counties about where we stand in right now and learning?
I don't see a problem with that, but relative to what? When you say snapshot, what kind of information
like
do you require?
The number of students and the number of, if they knew from last year to this year, how many have gone, whether they're in public schools, private schools, charter schools, even though they're public schools, anything like that, any data that they might have on that to help us see?
If you're in a deal-making mood, I got a deal for you. bullet point the specifics you want and send them to Brian, and we will do the best we possibly can to answer and accommodate those bullet points.
I think it's already out there in other places.
It'd just be assembling and putting it together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional comments from members of committee? Staff, anything? Did I miss anything? Do I need to say anything? You sure? That's a first. And members, join us today. Thank you so very much for giving of your time to be with us today. You're always welcome at the People's House committees, and I look forward to seeing you in further committee meetings. No further instruction for me to do anything for anybody. The meeting is adjourned.